19th, 1999, we're in the living room of the home of Dr. Alfred Bloomstein. This is Judy Rubenstein and Howard Braun interviewing. This is our second session, and we were speaking last time about your getting into Pratt.
Right. I graduated from high school in February. Mm-hmm. And
What year?
1947.
Okay.
And most colleges didn't have entering classes in February, but Pratt, being in New York City, did. And so I got a scholarship to Pratt and started there. I was one of the few non-veterans in a class. So my history of being a young kid was amplified by the fact that these were mostly veterans, and I was still appreciably younger than they, and I was commuted about an hour and a half to school. I lived in the Bronx, the school was in Brooklyn, and so I did my first semester in the spring, and then finished the second semester in the summer, so that by September I would be up with a sophomore class in electrical engineering. During that time, I took the exam for the New York Region Scholarship, which was awarded by assembly districts, and ended up being awarded one of those. And then was told that, I think the first 200 in the state were awarded Cornell scholarships. I was told I was on a waiting list for that, and in late August got the word that I was one of the recipients of a scholarship to Cornell. That was rather exciting, but was filled with all kinds of trauma. My relatives were putting a heavy pressure on that I should not leave the city, because my mother would be left all alone. And so I was torn about whether I ought to go or not. I did finally go up there, and the place was in enormous turmoil. They didn't have enough housing. There were lots of veterans coming back. I learned that I couldn't get into a four-year engineering degree, that I would need that the engineering program was now a five-year program. Not only that, but that I could get credit for a good part of my 1 year at Pratt, but not all of it, so I would have to spend the following summer at summer school. Things were enough of a turmoil. I ended up spending a week there and then coming home. I had no housing, and I was about to send a letter to Cornell declining the scholarship. And my mother was taking it down to mail, and she came back, and she said that, no, you really should go. And I thought about it, ended up going back, and it was a wonderful decision, but it was impressive that she cleared. I came that close, and she very much at another significant self deprivation saw to it that I went off. Anyway, I started in electrical engineering at Cornell, and discovered I was going to have to take courses in power line transmission theory and a lot of stuff that had really no interest to me. And Cornell had just started up a program in engineering physics. It was designed to follow up some of the experiences of wartime, where the engineers knew the handbooks, but they didn't understand the theory. Physicists knew the theory, but they didn't know what to do with it. And so here was a strategy to train people who really had a stronger grounding in the physics of phenomena, but also knew how to bring it to practice. Most of my colleagues identified as physicists, somehow or other, I ended up developing an engineering orientation, and throughout my time have always felt like an engineer, making things go better.
What, had you been interested in engineering before? No. What made you even think to go into that?
Number one, I needed a major that was going to get me a job when I finished. Because my mother had no great assets. I had no assets. My father was not earning very much. So, and the only jobs I saw were accounting, which a number of cousins had been in, which seemed to be boring, and engineering. And
did many people go into engineering in 1947?
Not many that I knew. I mean, the engineering college was filled, as all colleges were filled, but it was a field that Jews were discouraged from going into because of anti-Semitism in industry, a tradition of anti-Semitism. But somehow or other, that didn't faze me. And I really had no idea what engineering was about. I had no idea what engineers did. But it was a job, it was a profession, and so I followed through with it. When I ended up getting very interested in lots of extracurricular activities, I ended up being the president of what was then the Engineering Student Council. And throughout my career, I've gotten involved in a variety of extracurricular things. And I had a sense that I was probably the first Jew who was involved. I mean, there were still very few Jews in engineering, but I ended up becoming a significant actor dealing with the dean in a variety of those areas. It was a very solid education. I think I learned a heck of a lot. I learned about methods. I learned about physics theory. But I came out knowing that I didn't want to work in a physics lab. I was thinking of law. And in my senior year, I read an article in Fortune magazine that talked about this new thing that had come out of World War II called operations research. It was scientists working on military operations, using their scientific methods, mathematical analysis, and it was one of those very glamorizing articles, and I said, gee, that's exciting stuff. I really ought to do that. Would love to do that, but it really... Based on the article, you really had to be a genius to do it, and I knew I wasn't a genius. So how could I possibly get into that? And Korea War had started in 1950. I graduated in 51, so the war was underway. And I went out on job interviews, and it turned out that the best job offer I got was from a place called the Cornell Aeronautical Lab, a research lab in Buffalo, owned by Cornell University, to join an operations research group that was studying fleet air defense, defending naval vessels against air attack. And so I was immersed in operations research in 51. A year later was the founding meeting of the Operations Research Society of America, which was in Washington, and I got permission to go to that. So that was the first meeting of that society. I joined it and have been involved in that field ever since. Ended up being president of that group in the late 70s. And then a sister organization showed up, the Institute of Management Sciences. I ended up being president of that in the late 80s. And then in the 90s, those two organizations were merged into the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences called INFORMS, and ended up being the second president of that. So that was really the discovery of the field.
Uh-huh.
I really wasn't sure where to go, but that sounded very exciting. I was working in, but this lab was an old Curtis Wright wind tunnel, basically, when Curtis Wright used to be in Buffalo. They were about to close it down, but the Eastern...
And Curtis Wright was a...
airplane manufacturer, mm-hmm. and they had this wind tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
The Eastern airplane manufacturers, like Grumman and Northrop, like Grumman anyway, there were some others on Long Island, wanted to keep that tunnel going, so they got Cornell to take it over, and Cornell assured Cornell that there wouldn't be any economic loss, that they provided a starting capital, and that provided a basis for building a much more generic and important institution doing mostly defense research that went into a variety of other areas at a later time. I was there for about 2.5 years, and then the Office of Naval Research in Washington was setting up a project on defending fleets.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted somebody to come down because we were a major operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a rather exciting time. I discovered Washington. We were in one of these temporary office buildings on 17th Street and Constitution Avenue, right next to the AEC.
The AEC being the
Atomic Energy Commission. And during that time, that was when they were holding the security hearings on Oppenheimer and lifted Oppenheimer's clearance. And there was a lot of hubbub that they were in the adjoining temporary building to ours.
Tell us more about the time of Oppenheimer.
Well, I wasn't involved. It was just a... I had no involvement. I just saw the hubbub around it. We did these studies. One of my colleagues there was an interesting guy named Robert Truax, who was a commander in the Navy, who had started working on at Annapolis during the war on JATO, jet-assisted takeoffs for airplanes. And Bob Truax became one of the major players in getting the U.S. into the space mission. Here, I was this 22, 23-year-old snot-nosed kid, and we did our studies on how to organize the Navy better in terms of defending the fleet. And the results of the study were sufficiently interesting that it was arranged that we would brief the Chief of Naval Operations. And part of the briefing, I think I had the biggest piece of the briefing, reporting to the Chief of Naval Operations how he ought to organize his combat intelligence.
What was his name?
Kearney. How they ought to organize their combat intelligence operations in the task force, which again was a rather exciting experience for this little kid to be able to do stuff that people really cared about and somebody as important as the Chief of Naval Operations cared about. That project was finished, went back to Buffalo, and ended up getting a grant to design, it was called Project STAG, Small Task Group. The idea that came out of the war was 4 carriers and a bunch of cruisers and a bunch of destroyers. And it became clear to me from the work I was doing that they didn't need all that firepower, all that ship power with nuclear weapons. So got a grant to design a small task group and worked at that and worried about the air defense issues, the offense issues, the anti-submarine issues, and had a team of about 5 people, submitted a report, and I think it had some influence, but I've never followed through with it. After I had been there for about 5 years, I concluded that this was sort of a good field, and Cornell was just starting up a PhD program in operations research, and I ran into the chairman of that department, a guy named Andy Schultz, and Andy said, "You ought to come down here and get a PhD." And so I went back in 56. I graduated in 51, worked for 5 years, went back in 50. Oh, during that time, that was an interesting story. During that time, as soon as I got to Buffalo, I decided I ought to take some courses at night. And I had taken a course from Andy Schultz in statistics and figured that statistics is something I really enjoyed. So I took a course in statistics at Buffalo, and I took a course in theoretical physics. So I took two courses at night just to take the courses. Then I figured, hell, if I'm taking the course, I might as well get a master's degree out of it. So, and the statistics program was in the industrial engineering department at Cornell. So I went to the IE department at Buffalo and said, you know, I'd like to register for a master's degree. Can I do that? They said, well, send your transcript. I sent the transcript, and he said, well, you've got about these 20 undergraduate courses to take first. After you take those, then we'll let you register for a master's degree. And then I went over to the statistics department at Buffalo, and they said, well, we'll give you credit for the stat course. We'll give you credit for this physics course. We'll give you, and you'll write a thesis, and you have two or three other courses to take. And so that seemed like a much better route. It turns out, interestingly, that when I went back to Cornell, my degree was out of the industrial engineering department. And about 10 years later, I had an offer from that industrial engineering department at Buffalo to be chairman of the department. Anyway,
yeah.
So...
PhD at Buffalo.
So I went back in 56.
Yeah.
They gave me, but by this time I had finished the master's degree at Buffalo. I did a thesis doing what people have been marveled at. It was a simulation of a ground controlled approach airplane coming into the ground to an airport, using the card program calculator, which meant I had to do the program in machine language. That is, I had to know what storage registers each of my variables was in, and so each of the commands was take the variable located in storage register 19, add it to the variable in storage registers 23, and put it in storage register 24. And with a code for the operation. So it was all numeric that a 22-year-old kid could do, but anyone past that would go nuts. So, and of course, Fortran followed, assembly language followed that, and Fortran followed that. But anyway, it was an interesting effort to try to do a simulation in computer machine language.
The topic was...
It was in the stat department, and it was on ground-controlled approach, simulation of a ground-controlled approach, with a controller telling the airplane to turn left, turn right, and so on.
You were obviously looking at things from an engineering and statistical point of view. Were you interested politically at all?
Yes. I was interested in social problems, and had a number of friends with majors in sociology when I was an undergraduate, and said, that stuff is really fascinating. I'd be very interested in it, but had no slack in my program and knew I had to get my degree and go on and get a job.
So you were in the Korean, you know, working in Washington during the Korean War. Did you have feelings about the Korean War?
I think the war was sufficiently remote to me. I was professionally involved, but didn't feel that it was a war we had to win. It was, I assumed it was a war we were going to win, and was doing my little bit to it. One of the factors, by the way, that contributed to the decision to go to the Cornell Aeronautical Lab was that was a defense industry, and was a basis for not getting drafted into the war. Anyway, I was there for 5 years. Oh yeah, the war had ended by that time, but the draft was still on, and I started to get the feeling that I'm not sure this is really where I want to be in the long run. And if I go to college, if I go back to graduate school, I'll probably get drafted. And I said, what the hell? That's what I want to do. And the idea of going back to graduate school was not, I didn't have the sense at that point that I was going to go to a university. It was strengthen my skills. Mm-hmm. It was strictly a sense of strengthening my skills. And so I ended up going back. Oh yeah, I did apply during the time I was a Cornell Aeronautical. I just didn't want this draft hanging over my head. So I did apply for the Navy, for OCS, and Officer Candidate mm-hmm. School, and applied for it and got turned down medically. So
what year was this?
This was in 55 or 56, just before I went to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in 56 that Eisenhower lifted the draft.
Mm-hmm.
It was after I had applied for OCS, mm-hmm. then Eisenhower lifted the draft, then I got word I was turned down medically. So that was the end of that. There was a sense that I might be doing this because it's draft deferrable or because it's what I really want. Anyway, went back to Cornell. They gave me a year's credit for my master's degree, so I was there for 2 years, and basically taking courses during that time and writing a few papers in courses. And after 2 years, decided I would go back to Buffalo and write my thesis in absentia, I felt I had done my thing there. And it was permissible, but the requirement was 3 years of residency. And Andy Schultz was my mm-hmm. faculty advisor. So I went, by this time, Dolores and I had gotten married in January of 58.
Well, we'll get into some of the personal.
We got married in 58. And there was an interesting convergence in our lives. In 58, I decided I'd go back to Buffalo, to the lab,
mm-hmm.
and continue working there, and then do my thesis while I was there. I felt I had the discipline to put it together mm-hmm. without being on campus, so chose to do that. Finished the dissertation in 60.
Mm-hmm.
You asked about being politically interested. Mm-hmm. We were living in a...
The dissertation by title?
The dissertation was the operations capacity of a runway. Mm-hmm. I had done a paper... One of the issues that was coming up, that was a time of a lot of turmoil in air traffic control.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the issues that had come up was how many planes can land on a runway at any time? How can you expand mm-hmm. the number of planes that can land on the runway? And the government was building high-speed turnoffs from runways, because somebody had done a paper earlier that showed that the capacity of a runway depends on how much time the airplane spends on the runway. I did a paper called The Landing Capacity of a Runway, which showed that the time on the runway is not a dominant consideration, but rather the separation distance between two successive airplanes to keep them from running into each other, what was the more frequently the consideration, that the runway occupancy time was not important. I'm told that the result, one of the results of this paper was that the FAA stopped the high-speed turnoff building. I mean, they were building essentially ramps so the planes could get off faster, and they stopped that program because they didn't need it to increase the landing capacity. So that was the start of it. That was the first one chapter. And then I started dealing with the issue of landings and takeoffs being interspersed in a runway, and with the takeoffs going wherever there was a gap in the landings. And the beauty of it was that it took account of some of the statistical variation across different types of airplanes, got into sequencing rules, and it was a rather nice dissertation, operations being landing and takeoff. And so that was kind of fun. That was finished in 60. I graduated in 60. I got my degree in 60.
Okay, you started talking about some political...
Oh, yeah. I was very intrigued in 1960 by John Kennedy. He was a very exciting guy.
I was hoping you'd finish... personal stuff, and I would have taken the...
Go ahead.
We'll come back. So I got very involved, and at that point, Dolores and I were living in a suburb of Buffalo called Amherst, which was largely Republican. There were more slots on the Democratic committee in Amherst than there were Democrats, I think. Mm-hmm. So a friend and I joined the Democratic Committee, and we decided that we would run an experiment. The experiment was political campaigning experiment, because I was no great politician, but I knew how to run experiment, and we decided that that what we would do is the place to campaign is the place where there's greatest variability in the turnout. So we looked at historical election data and organized an experiment. Places to campaign and not campaign, places with high variability, places with low variability. It turns out in the experiment that our campaigning didn't make a heck of a lot of difference. Obviously we weren't going to affect very much the way people voted in a presidential election just by knocking on their door. But it turned out that we did poorly in the places with high variability and well in the places with low variability. It turns out that the source of the variability was really the Republicanness of the district, because Democrats had to be politically conscious. They always voted. Republicans only bothered to vote when there was a hot election. So that gave rise to a decision the following year to close down the campaign office with a big flare. We sent letters out saying, we have been telling you, this was a local election, we've been telling you for the last number of years that the Republicans are doing a crummy job, you refuse to listen, we're going to stop campaigning. We didn't win the election, but we did better that year than we had ever done before. Anyway, that was my venture into active politics. Let's see. When Kennedy came in, I was very impressed by the guy. His press conferences were very exciting. And I was very impressed by Robert McNamara, who was this whiz kid from Detroit who really was looking to develop strategy. At that point, I started looking at university jobs. I kept getting invitations to university jobs, and I really wasn't very interested in those because mostly they wanted people to do mathematics, and I wanted to do interesting and important things to make things better.
You were talking about strategy and McNamara. One of the things that I thought of when you were, especially with strategy, a few years earlier, Kissinger had written his book on conventional warfare. Wasn't that 1956? I believe, with the strategy of warfare. And you were dealing with naval warfare in those same years. Did you ever...
Those two sets of ideas never really intersected.
Okay, not at all.
Not at all.
Okay, because they were concurrent.
Yeah.
Okay.
His was much more macro-political.
Okay.
Mine was much more operational.